Hello, friends, and welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel and Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Chris Casso.
Hello, hello.
How is everybody today?
All right.
Well, I've had this cold for 2 weeks now.
God, you've just got to be sick of the sickness.
It's never going to go away.
Well, it's become a part of me.
I wonder if you're going to have it next week, too.
Do you think it'll mutate your body?
I should give you the science comic about plagues.
Oh, there you go.
Oh,
delightful.
Lovely. Like, I need that in my brain right now.
Yeah, you do.
The science comic about plagues?
Yes. Yeah, they're sassy and anthropomorphic. Why wouldn't you want to?
That's one that you were
I'm
late
sorry,
gets
ben,
asleep.
Cutting you off.
That's all right.
Yeah. Is that one you reviewed?
No.
Didn't you review one where they anthropomorphosed diseases and things?
I think I did Human that? Body Theater.
Yeah. Is that the same team?
No.
I've developed this habit of watching YouTube documentaries on like haunted places if I'm up late at night before I go to bed. And it really, you know, it's...
And how does that help? Does that help your sleep hygiene at all?
Well, you know, probably I think the reason I'm up late is just because I've had another sip of bourbon. So like, it, you know, it doesn't really matter, but... Yeah, it's
haunted places.
It's interesting. All right, let's get on.
No. We're going back to this. Why are you up late at night watching YouTube videos about haunted places?
Well,
what is inspiring you to do this?
I pretty much do that too. I watch like lists on serial killers and murders,
it's just a thing.
Unsolved murders, and paranormal stuff.
I'm a big like fan of ritual. Right, I do like on days we record the podcast, right? I stop at Dick's and I get a burger and some fries,
right?
And then I sit there, and then I sit here in the in front of the store for a long time because ultimately I'm early. And I walk down to the gas station and get a bottle of water and a thing of candy, and that's my ritual for before we do this. So I found this YouTube series about haunted places, and it's this team. It's like an X-Files team, but it's two dudes. One is a super skeptic, and one is totally buys into hauntings and aliens and all that. And like watching their dynamic, as like one guy's like totally freaking out because he thinks something just touched his shoulder, and the other one's like, "Dude, you're crazy. Nothing's happening." And so it's just but they're actually going into like the Lizzie Borden house,
right?
And they're going into these really haunted places. And I've developed this, like, if I'm up late. I'm like, oh, turn on one of these YouTube videos about these haunted places and watch these two goofballs just like go into these old haunted houses.
But these are real life dramas. They're not fabricated stories.
I mean, no, it's supposed
to be reality.
It's not
YouTube.
Acting.
No, it's not acting.
Okay.
It's a doc.
Did you never watch Ghost Hunters on Sci-Fi Channel?
I've never.
It ran for years.
I've never watched Ghost Hunters.
Yeah.
I was, however, at the Merchant Cafe in downtown in Pioneer Square, which is Seattle's oldest restaurant. We're getting way off the rails.
It's all right,
but it's the
it's
Merchant Cafe.
It's on topic.
You could,
sort
you could
a little bit.
Yeah, actually,
bit,
it is.
You could cue it in. Yeah,
because
just wait, listeners.
you're gonna love this segue.
All right.
So I was there, and I was part of a film crew that was there, and I asked the waitress who was babysitting us while we were there if they have a lot of film crews come in, and she says, "Oh yeah. This is a haunted restaurant, and all those ghost hunting shows come here all the time." And so, yeah, if you're in, and I tried to look for some on YouTube to see if I can find any of these ghost hunting shows at the Merchant. When I was there, I didn't really, it was like in the middle of the day, so, you know, there was nothing happening. But I did have somebody come up, because we were locked out at first. I did have somebody come up. And some guy who apparently hadn't stopped drinking yet, even though it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said that he was there last night, and he was in the basement because it's Pioneer Square. And so like street level's the second floor. So he was on the original first floor in the basement, and he was all alone. And he said, "Is anything here with me?" And he said he heard a growl. And I'm looking at him going, I'm like nodding my head going, "Okay, don't engage." And he just kind of stumbles off. And I'm like, "Really? A growl?" It's probably just the bartender wanting this dude to leave so he can clean up. Anyway, hey, speaking of horrible things happening. All right, so we've talked about body horror before, and body horror just sounds like a terrible, terrible genre of torture porn. But this is an explain to Ben moment. What exactly does body horror mean?
So
I'm looking at Chris.
I have an internet.
You're looking at me.
I'm looking at Nicole.
I have an internet search if you want me to say
that. Yeah, do
that.
I
am
maybe
curious,
Chris?
What the... Because I have my definition, but we didn't really start talking about it, and or at least it really didn't start resonating in my head until a couple months ago when you reviewed I Am a Hero, the manga zombie comic.
Okay, so I'll say then we can expand on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Body horror, biological horror, organic horror, or visceral horror is horror fiction in which the horror is principally derived from the graphic degeneration or destruction of the physical body. Such works may deal with decay, disease, parasitism, mutation, or mutilation. See, so that's what the internet says.
And when we were talking about it, I started breaking it down.
Yeah, we have like subcategory groupings, which kind of deal with a lot of this.
But do you think that zombie stories are necessarily body horror? Because I don't know.
Yeah,
that
I think they technically are.
Yeah,
because they fall within the decay part of that description.
The decay. Yeah.
To me, body horror is actually starts with the Cronenberg aesthetic.
Yeah, we were talking about Cronenberg.
Split.
Yeah.
Is that your mind is not in control of what your body is doing, or to put it more simply, your body has a mind of its own, because that's what a lot of his stuff, if you've seen films like The Brood and Scanners, particularly The Brood, which was all about the evil of the subconscious turning your body against you and budding other homunculi off your own body, off your own skin. It was just disgusting.
Very weird physical stuff.
And there's that other one he did with James Woods that I always forget the name of.
Is it
that
the Existenz one?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Existenz is great.
Yeah,
are you thinking of Videodrome?
Videodrome.
Oh, it's Videodrome.
Well, Videodrome is a collision of technology in the body, to be sure, because there's so and media manipulation of our psyche and stuff. Cronenberg's kind of brilliant. He's just got a hard aesthetic to get your head around.
Right.
His messages are either idiotically simple or so complex we're still trying to figure out what he's trying to say. I haven't figured him out yet.
See, I would also throw in like Kafka in that range. And then we also talked about, well, Lovecraft is a big one. Mm-hmm. But Lovecraft also gets in the idea of the bloodlines getting tainted, the horror of heritage, and the fish people of Innsmouth and all that, and incestuous relationships and the breakdown after that and stuff like that.
To my mind, that's how he negotiated his racism, and that's where the racism of his stories resonates the most, is that fear of the other being us. Particularly with like the horror over Innsmouth, when you know we are descended from frog people and we return to frog people. And there are a lot of his shorter stories where people return to like the old manor home and find out that the creepy crawlies that live under the floorboards are actually the ancestors of the protagonist or of the storyteller. That's not particularly horrific until you get down to the brass tacks of what he's saying about fear of ourselves and fear of the other.
And one of the things that kind of launched this idea of us talking about it was that you had finally seen Shin Godzilla.
Yes.
And I made it a point to see it.
Yes.
And then I gave it to Nicole.
Yes.
And so three out of four have seen Shin Godzilla.
I have not seen it, no.
But that has a kind of a body horror thing. It's
the
evolution of a body.
Yes.
And the horrible things that happen to it due to like nuclear radiation and all that stuff.
It is the goriest, most it's if it wasn't Godzilla, I wouldn't think call it a Godzilla movie.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's a very different kind of Godzilla.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's kind of the style of the director who's known for Neon Genesis Evangelion, where there is some like really horrible body mutilation / mutation stuff happening throughout it. So this reeked of him all the way through as I was watching it.
The other movie that comes to mind when you say that is District 9.
Yes.
Oh,
and, just like,
absolutely.
I can handle a lot of horror, but watching that dude pull his fingernails off and his teeth out just kind of makes
the
skin crawl.
The fly. Well. The fly is one of the things that Chris and I were going over too, because of mutation.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of manga that I think represents that as well.
Yeah.
One we mentioned was Parasite.
Yeah, Parasite's fantastic. Parasite is so, if we're talking about Parasite, we're also talking about John Carpenter's The Thing kind of style.
Yes.
And Parasite's great because these spores come to Earth and they naturally seek to go into the head of sleeping creatures. And one of them screws up and goes into the hand of a guy, and it consumes his hand and replaces his hand. But if they consume somebody's head, they replace the sentience of that person, and they want to eat humans. And so they can look like a normal human head on top of a body, but it mutates into this horrible John Carpenter monster and kills like crazy. So this is kind of like, what if the thing landed in a more populated area and already started going? I really love Parasite. It's weird because it has a sense of humor at it too, because the guy becomes friends with his alien hand and they just want to survive because the hand knows it's screwed up and the other aliens think it's dirty now because it didn't replace the right body part.
How long ago? I've never seen that film. How long ago was that produced?
Parasite's a book.
Yeah. Parasite's a book.
It's a manga.
It's a manga.
We switched to comic books.
Oh, gosh,
from movies.
You guys.
I think we're bouncing back and forth.
Oh, I thought it was a movie.
There's an animation of it, so that you can watch that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's lot of fun, and I could lend you Parasite.
But it's not. But there is a movie called Parasite.
There probably
but
is.
But it's just not based on this property.
No, that does remind me of the movie Parasite Eve, which has body horror, which is based on a game.
Parasite Eve is a game, yeah.
It's about mitochondria at some point decide, screw humans. And mitochondria start to evolve on their own, and they horribly rip flesh apart and turn into monsters.
Yes.
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 It's PS1 game.
Yeah, back in the day.
Ghosts and demons don't keep me up at night. That stuff is what keeps me up at night. Yeah. Cells plotting against me.
Yes.
Your body having a mind of its own.
Exactly.
That's a good turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Junji Ito is another master of body horror stuff.
Absolutely.
And Uzumaki is about a town haunted by spirals. And
I've seen the film Spiral. Yeah. Have you ever seen the actual film?
Yeah.
The live version, live adaptation of it? It's a trip.
It's a trip. And some of the people start mutating into snail creatures because of the spirals. Yep. And then like somebody shoves himself into a washing machine because it turns them into a spiral. So more body horror there, you know.
Yeah, and that image is like the only thing that stuck with me. I saw that movie and the dude looking out from the washing machine. Like every time I opened up my washing machine at home, I'm like, okay, there's a dude in there.
That movie messed with your mind because I remember there being sequences where it's something really mundane is happening, but off on the far side of the screen, there would be these little whirly images happening in the brush or something like that, because as these spirals take over everything, that's what bothered me the most. And there was a lot of Asian horror where they were doing things like that.
So Asian mythology is rich in body horror, and a lot of the yokai demons are like these horrible concepts. There's a particular one from the Philippines that Hellboy had in it that is like a woman's head, and then you can see the esophagus going to the intestines in the stomach, and it flies around eating babies or something like that. So there's
is that the one that has the very, very, very long neck?
That's a different yokai demon.
Because there's like dozens and dozens of yokai.
There's a lot of them.
I actually have all four of the Dai Toei Studios films, and they're all out of print. And there's only one of them. I think it's Spook Show or something like that. But I collected them all because I love the yokai creatures in themselves because they're fascinating and they have their own individual mythologies that the films don't cover. But if you ever find if you can find those Toei Studio yokai films, I do recommend them. They're a little slow, but they're goofy as all get out. Not so much body horror in that. I think those were made for kids.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting off topic. I'm good at that.
Cool. Body horror. Is there any other good examples? We've listed a lot of great examples of body horror. What makes it so unique from other types of horror? Is it that because each one of us owns a body?
Yeah.
And so,
well, it's like you said, like monsters, demons, whatever, but the idea of your body betraying you.
Yeah.
It's inside you instead of something outside trying to get to you.
And that's why I would argue that zombie stories are not body horror, because the zombie is no longer conscious of that loss of control. But in other stories, like the Cronenberg stories in particular, The Fly, that person is totally aware of losing control of their body as it does its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas zombies, I mean, I think that with modern zombie stories, we, the observer of the zombies, of course, are terrified by that walking decay, that mindless decay that we can't control. But to me, Godzilla leaking fluids and having
Has there ever been a zombie story told from the point of view of the zombie.
Yeah, there's been plenty. There's been a lot of ones that are a little bit more lighthearted, too.
Yeah, there was that one about the one that fell in love with a girl. And
it was like warm bodies.
Yeah, and the love made him heal.
Yes.
Yeah, there and he was, came back
oh,
to life.
That's BS.
There was one
it was so enjoyable.
Like,
I liked it.
There was one, it had like a dog name
Fido.
Or something. Fido. Oh, Fido.
Fido's
yeah.
great.
That one was a pretty good
one.
Yeah,
where the housewife falls in love with the pet zombie.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Fido
was the totally bizarre film with the weird aesthetic because the film is set in this community that looks like it stopped evolving in the 50s.
Yeah, like Atomic Family style.
Yeah. This bubble community, so, and there's Return of the Living Dead 3, which is actually really really creepy. I love the first Return. This film has nothing to do with the previous two Return of the Living Dead films, but this one is a smaller scope story of a romance, and his girlfriend comes back from the dead.
Is she the one that starts like piercing herself with thingies? Yeah. Oh yeah, Hellraiser. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Speaking of piercing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So one of the, I mean, if anybody here watches Game of Thrones, they'll know that they, and I'm no spoilers if you haven't seen it, but the zombies are coming, and so the two like warring houses have to come together to fight the zombies. It's like the two enemies coming together to fight a common evil.
Mm-hmm.
In comics, are there stories? You see where I'm going with this, right?
Good transition.
Are there stories where the hero and the villain have to team up to fight a greater evil for the greater good?
All the time.
All the time. Yeah. Well, wait on us. What are some examples?
So one of the frequent ones that tends to happen is Lex Luthor and Superman. And there's a really great sequence at the end of the final crisis event. Superman is facing like Darkseid's forces, and Lex Luthor and Dr. Sivana have reversed the anti-life equation and figured it out, and Superman's like, oh, you did good work, and Lex Luthor's like, don't ever tell anyone about this. And then Darkseid, we team up with Darkseid like every like Tuesday or something, because at Cosmic Odyssey we teamed up with him, and Crisis on Infinite Earths he fought the Anti-Monitor with us, and then Our World's at War he fought Imperiex with us, and at the end of each one he's just like, this is a one-time offer, and it's just like, is it? Then there's a time Dr. Doom joined the Future Foundation.
Yes.
And what was great about that, there was a story within that where there's a council of alternate reality Reed Richards, the Council of Reeds, and they...
This predates the Council of Ricks, by the way.
And they were kind of a bunch of...
Rick and Morty.
Yep. They were kind of a bunch of douchebags, and so Reed Richards was having trouble figuring out how to deal with them, and so...
Kind of like Rick Sanchez. Anyway, yeah. Keep going.
And they invited all the villains of the Fantastic Four to, like, a symposium, and Dr. Doom hosted it, and he's like, hey, everybody, here's Reed Richards. We get to figure out how to kill Reed Richards with him in the room. And so they set loose all these villains together to kill the worst Reed Richards.
Is that the Fantastic Foes series?
Or am I that was something else. Okay. Yeah, I think that was the Robert Kirkman one.
All right.
And then going into my Transformer place. My happy place. In the comics, they made it a point that there was this... there's a character named Shockwave in the cartoon. He was just a lackey. But in the comics, when he showed up, he killed everybody. Like... everybody, and he took over and he said Megatron is worthless. So at some point the medic of the Autobots, Ratchet, and Megatron teamed up to fight Shockwave, and they teamed up so much that later on they were in an explosion together and they literally melded into one person. Oh. So they were always kind of stuck together, like their minds were trapped with each other. So yes, team-ups happen quite a bit because there's always somebody worse.
Shockwave was kind of neutered in the cartoon.
He was neutered. Yeah. Like, in the comics, like, he killed all the Autobots with one shot when he showed up.
Dang.
And he was like, I'm done.
Yeah. Well, that's like Darth Vader in the comics versus the movie.
Yeah.
Like, in the movie, you're like, well, I guess he's bad guy. And in the comics, he's like snapping necks. Like,
Yeah.
He's. I'm reading the ongoing Darth Vader series right now, and I think I read the fourth issue today. And he is... merciless, like the Darth Vader we're depicting right now in this comic book is not the Darth Vader that would have my sympathies at the end of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah,
no, he is brutal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's been a few times with Batman and the Joker coming together to solve a murder mystery. Half the time, it's a trap by the Joker,
of course.
But there's a couple issues of them doing it.
cool.
Yeah. Did you guys think of any others?
I don't know.
My Onslaught.
Oh, God. Yeah, Dr. Doom helped on that one, too.
Yeah, Dr. Doom helped that when Professor X and Magneto became one entity.
Oh, Magneto's like the first person to ever switch sides.
Sure.
All the time. Yeah.
His poles reverse.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you did there, buddy. Yeah. I see what you did there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, all the time. Because generally, he's not a bad person. He just really gets pissed at humans. So when somebody worse comes in, then he's always willing to punch a Nazi.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a great crossover where it was called the Axe of Vengeance, where all the villains were like, "Ooh, let's do musical chairs. Let's switch heroes." And they were all sitting together, and somebody like placed him next to the Red Skull, and like he's staring at the skull, like burning holes through him. And then later on, he just went and tried to kill the Red Skull. He was like, "Screw the crossover. I'm killing the Nazi." So, you know.
Well, and that's unfortunately is a byproduct of when you have a comic continuity that's as old as Marvel and DC, because originally Magneto was a survivor of a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And we can't do that anymore because, you know, the younger reader is not going to be able to relate to that. It's like the Punisher not being from.
They kept that, though. They
did
haven't
they?
Changed that.
Did
he's,
they?
He's still. I'm pretty
Why?
Sure they did.
Okay. Because I thought we had a conversation about how those things fall through the cracks, you know. Case in point was like Frank Castle,
yeah.
And whether he fought in Vietnam or in Afghanistan,
they pushed Punisher out, but they made it a point with Magneto because they released a special where it was all about the Holocaust,
all right.
And that's used in classrooms sometimes.
Yeah. Well, there is a mini series that came out.
Yeah, that's the one I'm
that's
thinking
the one.
Of.
It's quite good.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. That's great. All right. Thank you, because I thought all that had been cast to the wayside. Yeah.
There's some. There was a Captain America Batman crossover that placed them in the 40s, and the Joker and the Red Skull are the villains. And at some point, Joker realizes, like, wait a second, what? And he's like, I may be an insane criminal mastermind, but an American criminal mastermind, which is my favorite part of The Rocketeer. Mm-hmm. When the Nazis finally show up and the one gangster's like, wait a second, I'm still an American.
I may be a criminal, but I'm an American.
Speaking of punching Nazis, I was reading up on Jack Kirby his 100th birthday was a couple days ago on August 28th. And there's this great story about after Captain America came out, he's up in his office. I think he was working at Marvel at the time.
Yeah,
and he gets a call from like the receptionist downstairs. And she says, there are these three Nazis here who want to have a word with you about Captain America. And he's like, I'll be right down.
Yeah.
And the receptionist
up.
Yeah, the receptionist says he's coming down and he's rolling up his sleeves. Mm. And the Nazis scrammed.
Yeah. And that's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, it's a fun story. Mm-hmm. All right, so cool. Any final shout outs for hero villain team ups before we move on? I think we said a lot.
Yeah. Just go punch a zombie and punch a Nazi.
Yeah.
Punch a Nazi zombie.
If you have two fists, do it at the same time.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's move on to book report, everybody. And this is a special book report. This is actually the owner of Comics Dungeon. Actually, he's no longer the owner. He's
the president of the board.
President of the board of
Director
C3. Yep. And Scott Tomlin, and he gave us, each one of us, a book to read, to review. And so
he assigned them to us.
He assigned them to us. So let's have Nicole. Let's have you go first.
Okay, so he assigned me Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the
that
way
is a big book.
It's a huge.
I didn't read all of it, so don't get too excited.
Oh.
So I have the library edition that's beat to all something. And it collects two trades worth, so I just read my trade worth because I was sleepy. Mm. So it starts with seasons. So
right.
Buffy, the original TV show, went through seven seasons. This is the start. There was some Dark Horse material, but they started the season stuff. With season 8, and this is called The Long Way Home, The Long Way Home, and it has, let's see, so Whedon did work with Brian K. Vaughan, I think, on writing this. He probably did, like, the scripting or whatever, the plotting or whatever, and then Joe Chen did, like, beautiful cover art, and who's the guy? Jorge Genti? Is that how you say his
Genti?
Name?
Yeah, I think
Genti?
It's Shanti, but I could be wrong.
Okay. He does the bulk of the art in this one. So the thing to note about this is that you do need to be fresh on your Buffy, and not just like the last season, but like characters that showed up throughout the season. So for example, Amy, who was a witch who turned evil, mm-hmm. and I think she shows up like pretty early on in the Buffy show. She shows up in this first story arc. And then there's Andrew, and Andrew was the dorky guy who killed his friend because there was some guy talking to him and he killed him on an altar and opened up the altar for demons or something. Mm-hmm. He was like really weird kind of guy who liked to to videotape Buffy. Mm-hmm. So there's things like that that show up in here, and it's been maybe 5 years since I've watched the Buffy series. So there was a lot of stopping and starting to being like, who was that guy? Who is this person? So definitely I would recommend if you want to start this series that you do brush up on your Buffy, or if you haven't watched it, it relies very heavily on that. So this is after that she's had like, you know, all the army of slayers and stuff like that. And she's still like working with the girls. Dawn has turned herself into a giant. So she's huge. And it's funny because, you know, she doesn't have a great relationship with Buffy. She has a better relationship with Willow. And so, you know, maybe she turned herself big to get noticed by Buffy, you know, stuff like that. They hit really well with the way Buffy speaks. Like, it sounds just like, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar did in the show. And Xander's in here with his eye patch, and he's like, when he's not doing construction, I guess he's helping, being like the Nick Fury, and they make Nick Fury jokes, you know. The one thing that I noticed about the pacing too is that it does it like it's a TV show. So you'll watch one, you'll read a panel and it's like watching a scene, and then you turn the page and it's cutscene to another scene. So it reads very much like an episode, and that took me a little bit of time. I don't know why, it just sort of hit me weird, and I was like, the pages are kind of thick, and I'm like, wait, what? And then Willow had been gone, and she shows back up, and she's like, oh, it's a long story, we'll talk about it later. So there's a lot of just little bits going from season 7, just kind of starting it out. Where are people now? What's going on with stuff? How is the Slayer army going, and demons showing up? And Amy had a boyfriend who Willow, I guess when she went really bad, did something terrible to him. I couldn't remember him either, but he shows up and he tries to capture Willow. So there's all sorts of stuff, tons of action. I think it's really well done. I would eventually like to go through all of the Buffy stuff. It's a lot of undertaking because there's 11 seasons right now.
See, what would be interesting is if you, how different they're, because the first chunk of this was written by Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He traded with Brian K. Vaughan, so they're separate.
Oh, okay, so yeah, that's
because
why.
Whedon went to write Runaways.
Oh, okay.
They did the job trade.
Gotcha.
So you do have two different tones within the book.
That's true.
But they're pretty close.
Yeah.
I feel Vaughn got it.
Yeah.
But
so
I'd now,
have to read the second volume in here to get that.
But Joss Whedon hasn't written it for quite some time.
Right.
So current stuff might
it's still ongoing, correct?
Still happening. Yeah.
Yep, still going.
Because I was a huge fan of the TV series, and I'm not a big fan of licensed properties and comic books and spinoffs, and that's, I usually avoid them. The fact that I read the Star Wars comic and that sort of thing is kind of a breach for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really excited about this series when it came out,
mm-hmm.
because I was actually suffering some grief after the cancellation of the series. And I stuck with this for about 3 or 4 years,
mm-hmm.
but it just absolutely, the horse was beaten to death as far as I was concerned, because we've done it all. And, you know, sometimes, and I had to, and I looked back and I went, you know, sometimes a series needs to end, and it needs to end gracefully. And there was something, I liked the first couple of arcs of this. I really, and I enjoyed the back and forth with Vaughn and Whedon, but it took away a lot of grace of the end, and it's still going on. So, and it just didn't work for me. It was unfortunate. I wish they would have ended it when they ended it, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I would probably ride this out a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
I know people who have stuck with it, and they seem to be... I don't really hear much, you know, but I would think that they would have already canceled it if they wanted to cancel it at this point. You know,
I
so
was
they're holding on.
I was kind of surprised it's still running.
It's a valuable property, the Dark Horse, so they're going.
Sure. It is.
They've lost all their other licenses for the most part.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not a huge Janty fan of his art, but... it's perfectly fine, you know, to be a vehicle for the story. So yeah, that first arc was interesting. So I think the telling point would probably be to read the Brian K. Vaughan stuff and revisit it and see how I feel after that.
Yeah.
And also probably rewatch all of Buffy.
We'll remember.
Which, you know,
see you later.
Well, yeah, I know. It's streaming.
Can you stream them all on Netflix?
Yeah, it's you know, it's something I could watch while I'm working my other job too, so I don't have to pay too much attention to, and then be like, oh, look, that guy showed up. Okay, great. You know, but there's a lot of YouTubing and Wikipediaing to just be like, I know this is a person. It seems like this is a person that I should know. Exactly, but it's just not fresh.
Right.
So.
Cool. Buffy the Vampire Slayer season 8. I actually have only seen the first two episodes of season 1 of Buffy. And that's all. I never got into it.
The first season is so formulaic. It's so monster of the week too.
Yeah.
And their production quality was, they were so dark at times I couldn't tell what was happening on the screen.
Yeah. It does change, like each season has a different sort of tone to it.
I was told I need to get past the first season, it picks up from
But see, that's a terrible thing I think to say to people because you have to sit through a whole season of something you don't care about to get to stuff that
I think there are some really great things that are established in the first season, but when it originally hit the airwaves, at least where I was living, it was syndicated late night. It was like on 11 o'clock at night.
And then
and it started picking up viewership, and they moved it to primetime. I remember that. Because it was that weird WB syndication stuff that was happening.
I liked the movie. I liked the Christy Swanson, Paul Rubens. I think Donald Sutherland.
Donald
was
in
it. Yeah. He plays the original Vampire Slayer.
Just try to get the spike.
Yeah. Just try to get
I like Spike a lot, and he has some really interesting things happen in season 6.
I think he's a local boy too. I think that actor
is a local boy.
All right. Well, thank you, Nicole. I'm gonna go next. Scott also assigned me Fables Volume 1, but Chris and Nicole gave me Volume 2 as well to read. So I'm gonna do both of them. And apparently, I'm it's a number one New York Times best-selling series, and it's still going on. I guess I'm the only one. Cole is shaking his head.
No,
they've stopped it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's wrapped.
It's wrapped.
He concluded the story.
Well, apparently I'm the only one who's never read this. And so it's...
You're still a good person, though, Ben.
Well, I haven't read a lot of things. If you don't know the story, it's basically the fables and fairy tales had their own homeworld. It was attacked by who they call the adversary. As of yet, we haven't met them. But they all, the humanoid fables live in like their own building in New York City, and the animal ones live in upstate New York, except for like the big bad wolf who has some sort of enchantment to, because he's not allowed on the farm, as they say.
Because he'll eat the piggies.
And so they have to keep away from the Mundies, what J.K. Rowling would call muggles. Mm-hmm. And it's the volume one is basically a murder mystery. Mm-hmm. And now this is a you have to pod-splain something to me because I am not up on my fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And it's actually interesting because there are some splash pages more so in volume two where you can go through and pick out different properties. Mm-hmm. But what the Snow White is like the administrator of Fabletown, and her sister is Rose Red. And I only know Snow White from the Disney adaptation, and so I don't remember her having a sister. So I was thinking, A, Snow White has a sister in the old fairy tales, and I just didn't know it. B, Bill Willingham just made her up as a plot device. Or C, it's Little Red Riding Hood for some reason. I thought it might have been Little Red Riding Hood. So
it's A.
A.
A, yeah.
Okay.
Red Riding Hood will show up later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Well, because then I thought it was interesting because the big bad wolf, is the detective. And if I thought, well, if it's Little Red Riding Hood, he's trying to solve her murder, that's kind of a funny twist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, episode one, volume one basically ends with the murder is solved. And one of the things about it, I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. I didn't hate it. I did enjoy reading it. And the thing is, like I said, I am not up on my fairy tales. And so I'm sure a lot of the references and a lot of the characters just went over my head. I had no idea who they were. And so there's that thing like, you did your homework, Nicole, with Buffy. Like, if you didn't know somebody, you looked them up. Yeah. I didn't bother doing that.
Right.
It's probably a lot of people who show up here and there because they pack a lot of characters into these two.
It is dense.
Yeah, it is. And it ran like 15, 16 volumes.
21 or 22 or something. Yeah. Like that.
Right. I read them all, but and I loved the series, but I would wait for them to come out in trades and I'd buy them. But by the time we got to the last like four or five trades, I quit buying them. The first arc I think is probably the best when you're dealing with the adversary and stuff like that. But no, actually I don't think you need to be that well versed with the Grimm's fairy tales because he fills you in and he does play fast and loose with a lot of them as well.
Yeah. I never felt like I was missing anything. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those. There are people out there who got this more or better than I.
Possibly. Right.
And I think he says in the beginning, in the intro, that it's still going on, which is probably why I think it was still going on. Because it probably was when this was produced.
Yeah.
So he did an interesting thing when he wrapped it. The final story arc was not told in individual issues. It was actually, the conclusion of the story was a graphic novel.
Yep.
Ah,
yeah.
And so I also read part two, Animal Farm. Ha ha. Mm-hmm. Little nod to Orwell there. It's a bit of a different
tone.
Yeah, it is a different tone, and I think that's why you gave it to me because volume one was like murder mystery. Let's solve the murder. There's even flashbacks of panels where like, all right, the stereo didn't have any blood on it because Rose Red didn't want to get her stereo messy, but this is all about the farm revolting,
mm-hmm. right?
And the pigs are the catalyst, the ringleaders of the revolt. Another nod to Animal Farm there,
along with Goldilocks.
Yeah, and Goldilocks
is the gorilla warfare.
Her suspicious relationship to the bears,
the baby bear.
What caught me off guard is that it is dark.
Yes,
it is very dark.
I was surprised at a couple of things that happened because I had not expected it.
Yeah,
and so because justice is meted out in a very severe way.
The way it is in the Grimm's fairy tales, mm-hmm. you know, because when you brought up the Disney films earlier, and that was something I remember my mother telling me when I was a little boy, because she would take me to see the Disney fairy tale films, and she would say, these are not the way the original stories were told.
Yeah.
These have been really tamed and dumbed down, and the messages have been radically changed, and she would tell me the scary things about, like, Cinderella and chopping off toes.
How old were you when your mom was telling you these things?
I was, like, probably 5 or 6.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a big art change between the two of them. Did you have a preference between the two?
Okay, so the big art change is I think the lines are cleaner in season two. The characters are a bit more simple. It feels like there's a lot more texture in
the first one. Yeah.
I wouldn't say I had a preference. I mean, I'm glad that the change didn't happen mid-story, because that would have jolted me.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe, I think...
Because the person who took after Volume 2 is the regular one for the rest of the series.
Buckingham draws.
So you should probably like that one more. Because
you don't have to like him. I'm just curious which one hit you stronger.
You recall that Steve Laiola ink it for the entire movie?
Yeah.
Laiola is one of those underappreciated inkers. He's one of those inkers who you think you're in love with the artist's artwork and you realize what you're in love with is his inking.
Yeah.
I think he's a marvelous inker.
It strikes me that, Volume 2 is more of a comic book style.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know really what I mean by that. It's just kind of...
Volume 1 is a little bit more realistic. Volume 2 is more stylized.
Yeah. So, Fables, Animal Farm, and also Volume 1, Legends in Exile, both by Billy Willingham. If you haven't checked it out, why are you listening to this podcast? Because you probably have already read it, if you're listening to us. So, I enjoyed it. Check it out.
Do you think you would... Yeah, keep going.
I probably will.
It really was one of my favorite series.
And it goes on for, like, 15 series?
21.
21?
Yeah, 21 or 22. Books.
With side stuff if you care. Like, Jack gets his own series.
Cinderella gets her own.
Yeah, the Jack of Fables got tedious.
Yeah, you could skip some of that. Yeah.
And Bigby has, I think, one or two standalone graphic novels.
He also has a Telltale game series.
That's right.
Called Wolf Among Us.
Which is pretty fun.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Thank you, me. Let's move on to Cole Hornaday. What do you got for us?
Well, Scott asked me to read Valiant's Exo Man of War Soldier. And I actually read the first issue of this when it was a freebie about was it a year ago or more?
Yeah, about.
And I thought it was quite good. I read the Valiant books, sporadically back in the 90s when it originally launched, and I thought they were all pretty good efforts, but diluted and petered out before too long. They hit hard with a lot of inspired work and then just sort of started to reveal themselves as being analogs to other established books. And one book that I did not read back in the day was Exo Manowar, because it was very clear to me that it was an analog for Iron Man. And it is and it isn't. So in their efforts to reboot the Valiant universe, it's not something I paid a lot of close attention to, and maybe Chris can help me out here. They've kind of fine-tuned their universe, the shared aspect of the worlds, but they're still evolving in their own direction. So essentially the premise of Exo is that you've got Eric, who is a Viking or a German, a Berber, barbarian. Under the Roman Empire.
Under Roman Empire time. And, there's a particular word, and
somehow he managed to connect with a warrior suit.
Yeah, alien AI. Suit lands on Earth,
yeah.
And he gets it.
And makes him Iron Man and a super warrior.
Yep.
And I'm not really, but in the start of this story, Eric is now trying to live a peaceful life on a distant planet where people are blue. He only has one arm, and he would prefer to live his life as a peaceful farmer in
Visigoth.
He was a Visigoth.
He was a Visigoth. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. On the planet Gorn. Not a Visigoth on the planet Gorn.
No,
but as the story opens, he's on the planet Gorn.
He's a hermit on the planet Gorn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, he's got a lover.
He's got a lady.
Yeah, yeah.
He could be a hermit with somebody.
He has a blue lady friend. And wouldn't you know, his life of peace and solitude is interrupted by war, and he gets conscripted into this conflict. It's written by Matt Kint. And I did read some of Kent's stuff. I read Mind Management, and I really enjoyed it for what it was, but it didn't really hook me. And this is drawn by Thomas Giorello and Diego. I think Diego Rodriguez is probably the inker. The selling point of this story is Giorello's pencils are just absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
He reminds me a bit of old school Bill Willingham, EC.
Al Williamson.
Al Williamson, thank you. And Frank Frazetta.
Reminds me a little bit of Thomas Nord, too.
Yep.
Or Cary Nord.
Cary Nord. Yeah. And this book gives you the benefit of the reproducing the uninked pencils, uncolored pencils in the back, and you can really get a good look at how lavish Giorello's pencils are. The story is really not anything new. He gets conscripted, and because he's a seasoned warrior, and he has the Exo, he doesn't actually lean on the Exo armor at all throughout the story. It's just his wits, his experience as a warrior, mm-hmm. and his pureness of heart. And he begrudgingly, winds up leading the blue people soldiers to victory. And it's a lot of action, a lot of unique design aesthetic that I really appreciated. Did not care much for the plot because, like I said, we've been here before, but the artwork is really, really stellar. And it's, my understanding is, part of an arc that goes soldier, general,
king, something like that.
Right. So yeah. it's his Conan of Samaria arc to power, mm-hmm. though he begrudgingly, assumes that role.
Mm-hmm.
I do recommend it because of Giorello's artwork. I feel that I've fallen down on keeping up on the whole Valiant rebirth, and I think I probably expressed that before. It's been real hit or miss for me, though I've tried to go and get collected volumes like Archer and Armstrong. I did read Faith and some books. It's just kind of been hard for me to keep up with the Valiant stuff, just because it's hard enough for me to keep up on the other universes that are out there.
Right.
But that's not saying that this is not a worthy piece of work.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. Exo Manowar, thank you, Cole. You and bet. Finally, Chris Casso, what was your assignment?
I was assigned the young animal's title, Shade the Changing Girl, by Cecil Castellucci, Marley Zarcone, and Andy Parks. This is a continuation from the original Vertigo Shade the Changing Man, which followed an alien from the planet Meta who was sent to Earth to prevent madness from taking over the planet, and he had a madness jacket that can alter reality around him. And in the back of the book, because these are catered by Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance, and he basically said, like, yeah, this is a continuation, not a reboot. So all the original stuff took place. The original stuff was by Peter Milligan, who I have never been a fan of. Mm-hmm. So I'm coming to this without much knowledge of the series because I could never sit down and read all the original Shade. I just don't like his style. And I got to tell you, if I read this as a first issue, I would have burnt it on fire. I hated the first issue. It got better for me. The setup is that the original Shade is not the main character at all. An alien, a bird woman from the planet Meta, steals the jacket and teleports to Earth and occupies a brain-dead teenager named Megan. And off the bat, that may be kind of like, that seemed kind of like a horrible thing to do. And then as they reveal through the series, Megan was a horrible teenager. Her parents hated her. She was mean to everybody. She was a toxic human. So the alien, I think her name's Loma. Loma Shade is what she calls herself. She's kind of dealing with like this toxic, everybody hates her even though she's not her. And she's slowly kind of making up for this human's life and trying to be good. And you get moments where the parents are like, maybe we can keep this version of our daughter. You know, they hated their daughter so much.
That's terrible.
Yeah. And she doesn't really have too much control over the coat. So the world sometimes just melts away and weird things happen around people. So that's like the main push of it. And the spirit of Megan, the original teenager, comes back and she is as horrible as everyone made her out to be. And she's trying to take over her body again. So there's some interesting ideas. And like I said, the series read better to me as I progressed. I am very disappointed because the cover had this fantastic, happy-looking hippo on it. And the hippo never shows up.
What? There's
no happy, happy hippo?
Well, there's the
bait and switch there.
Well, there's some tiny hippos that show up in the hallucinations because the school's mascot is a hippo. And I'm like, please come back. Come back. I want the hippo more than I want the main characters.
Did you find yourself scanning ahead?
Yeah, it's like, where's the hippo? The art, I do really like the art. It's Marley Zarcone. It's very clean, and it works for the style of the madness they're trying, the psychedelic moments. It reminds me of some older Vertigo art styles from the late 80s and early 90s. There's some backup stories that feature Gilbert Hernandez, which is always weird, and it has nothing to do with the Shade the Changing Girl. There's another one about Dial H for Hero, just because. And there's one about Element Girl. It had some beautiful artwork in it. And then there's like some sketchbooks in the back. So, I mean, it's a good package. It got better for me. I just had a hard time really committing to it because I kind of came in with a pre, like, I don't really care about any of this feeling. And it didn't help me get over that. Mm. There is a cute corgi throughout it. That's a plus. So, yeah, it's if you did like the original Peter Milligan, you probably do want to give this a shot. It's a continuation of the concepts. The original character did exist, and they reference him plenty of times. But I just couldn't get too behind it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Cool. Thank you, Chris. Shade the Changing Girl. And that is Bookport, and that is our show, and coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com and Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street, beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. And now get your quiz. That's on everybody's quiz time. This week, these questions come to us from me.
What?
I know. We talked about zombies quite a bit this episode in honor of George A. Romero, who passed away on July 16th, 2017. Here are five questions about his zombie movies. Number one. 1968's Night of the Living Dead is considered to be the grandfather of the modern zombie genre. These are all multiple choice. It slipped into the public domain because why? A. The copyright had simply expired after 25 years. B. The producers refused to copyright the film to ensure more people would see it. Or C. The filmmakers forgot to put a copyright notice on the film. Paul Hornaday.
C.
It is C. At the time of its release, any work that didn't include the copyright notice was assumed to be in the public domain. This was simply an oversight on the filmmakers' part.
Yep. Oops. Well, I didn't think it was going to do anything. I didn't think it was ever going to see it.
Number two. 1978's Dawn of the Dead solidified the zombie genre as a metaphor for America's growing consumerism. Filming at the Monroeville Mall took place during the winter of 1977 through 78, beginning around 10 p.m. shortly after the mall closed, and finishing at 6 a.m. The mall didn't open until 9, so why did they finish so early? A. After the 8-hour shift, union rules stated they needed to cease production for the day. B. The mall's Muzak came on and no one knew how to turn it off. Or C. They had to use that time to clean up all of the blood before the mall opened.
I want to say C.
Yeah, I want to say C too.
No, the answer is B. The mall's Muzak came on. No one knew how to shut it off.
That's awesome.
Number three, 1985's Day of the Dead is the lowest grossing film in Romero's original Dead trilogy. However, Romero states that it is his favorite of the three. All of the extras who portrayed zombies in the film's climax received what for their services? A. A hat that said, "I played a zombie in Day of the Dead." B. A copy of the newspaper from the beginning of the film. C. $1.
$1.
$1, what's your guess?
A copy of the newspaper?
Chris?
I'll go with a hat.
You're all right. All of the above.
Right. Wow.
All right. Number four, 2005's Land of the Dead is so forgettable, yeah. I didn't even know it existed until I started researching questions.
Seriously?
For this quiz time.
Oh.
It has the distinction of being the first of George A. Romero's zombie films to do what? A. Refer to the zombies as zombies. B. Use digital effects. Or C. Have a budget that surpassed $1 million.
I want to say all of the above.
No, it's not all the above.
It's not that C. I think it's probably A.
Refer to the zombies as zombies. Yeah. No, the answer is B. It's the first one to use digital effects.
That's the one I refer to as Chewbacca zombie. Because there's the mechanic guy and he just goes, ah.
Oh, is that the same one?
Yeah, he starts leading the zombies.
Oh, I was thinking of the one where they're on like the island and there's like the feud between the country bumpkins.
I haven't even seen it. And finally, 2007's Diary of the Dead. Who even knew this movie existed?
Yeah,
all of these people have cameos as newsreader voiceovers in the movie, except for who? Find the one who isn't in the movie. Quentin Tarantino, Simon Pegg, Stephen King, Sigourney Weaver, Guillermo del Toro, and Wes Craven. Who does not have a cameo speaking role in the movie?
Tarantino.
Nicole, pick one.
Sigourney.
You are correct. It is Sigourney Weaver. The only one who didn't have a...
Sigourney.
All righty. Well, and that is quiz time. And that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.